There are two rules to remember if your friends won't return your calls and you're considering a lonely night of stabbing yourself in the solar plexus with a dull ice pick. Rule number one, never run out of imagination. Rule number two, never forget rule number one. You want to know why you should keep an ice cold pack of imagination on hand? You never know if your friends might show up. Now, I don't claim you can have a better time with imagination than without it, but why take chances? Imagination. Available in 40-ounce bottles. Brown bag optional.
Okay, so I am here with Jonah Lehrer, who is most recently the author of Imagine. Jonah, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. You put on the glasses. Have you always worn glasses? Because I noticed that was the new cover photo for this, whereas before you didn't have glasses.
Oh, I've been blind for a long, long time, okay. So I don't know, maybe I forget, maybe the photographer had me take them off.
They asked you to take them off. I was always
curious. Yeah,
no.
I didn't know
if it was like a new mild-mannered Clark Kent look or...
No. I can assure you that these glasses actually work.
Okay.
They help me see.
Good. Well, I'm more visible for you. That's reassuring. Let's go ahead and get right into it. Your book opens with this story of Continuum observing an elderly woman who is wetting a paper towel and wiping the remaining coffee grounds off of the linoleum as she was cleaning. This, of course, leads to the development of the Swiffer. You have, near the end of the book, you point out Shakespeare. He had the tendency to comb through the many books he read to find stories that he could use for plays and so forth. So it would seem to me, just to establish some terms from the beginning, that much of your notion of creativity involves the theft of ideas that if you have financial or intellectual resources and you're able to go ahead and pluck them from somebody else, then hey, you could be creative. So, how is profiting off of another person's idea a form of creation or art or whatnot?
I'm not sure I'd call it straight theft. I mean, I think Dylan actually has, I talk a lot about Bob Dylan in the book.
Yes, you do.
And he's got this wonderful phrase where he describes his process as one of love and theft, that first you fall in love, whether it's a Woody Guthrie style, whether it's a Robert Johnson riff, whether it's a old Irish lullaby from Ireland, which you turn into Blown in the Wind. And so you love it and you try to understand it and map out the intricate details and connections, and then you steal it and you make it your own. So this isn't straight theft. This is, in theory, Shakespeare, who, as you point out, was doing pretty well for himself. He came from very humble beginnings.
Yeah.
His father was a glover, signed his name with the mark, but he did his dad proud and made lots of money. So he didn't just steal Hamlet. He didn't just steal the plot for Romeo and Juliet, and he didn't just steal almost all his plots. Shakespeare did not like inventing his own stories, of course. He made them his own. He reinvented them. And I think it's the same thing Bob Dylan did with, that Robert Johnson riff. It's the same thing Continuum did with watching that elderly lady wipe up the coffee grinds that they'd actually spilled on her floor.
Yeah.
That she didn't invent the Swiffer, they invented the Swiffer. That triggered an insight, which then led them to combine the mop, which they'd spend 9 months studying and realizing that mopping's a terrible idea because you spend more time cleaning the mop than you do the actual floor. And then that, her simple act, something they'd all done themselves countless times, simply triggered their breakthrough. So in a sense, I think you're right to point out that all creativity involves a theft from somewhere. I think creativity is ultimately just a new connection between old ideas. So you are, in the most literal sense, thieving ideas which already exist. But the connection itself is new. At least it should be new. If it's not new, then it actually is straight up theft. And that's not the kind of creativity I'm interested in.
Yeah. But what is the creativity you're interested in? Because, I want to actually distinguish it from sort of an elaborate or high-class pickpocket. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think it's very easy to get lost in lots of circular discussions about how to define creativity. I think creativity, as far as I'm concerned, is a bit like porn. You kind of know it when you see it.
Oh, yeah?
Or at least that's what the Supreme Court said,
sure.
Of course. I think creativity is just the invention of something new. And I'm not saying new in some kind of pretend sense. I'm saying something genuinely new, which doesn't exist in the patent office, doesn't exist in the world that other people find useful.
Sure.
So that's as fancy as I get in defining creativity.
Well, let's get into conceptual blending, which you get into, people exchanging ideas across different disciplines. When you take two concepts and mash them together, which seems applicable to this notion of what is creativity, it has given us some regrettable and fairly negative ideas. I think that we can both agree that aerosol cheese spray, the car alarm, telemarketing, the pet rock.
Yes.
These are also things that come from conceptual blending. So, you know,
aerosol cheese spray. I'll go with you in the pet rock, but Cheese Whiz, aerosol, you know, that stuff in the can, that fueled me for much of my childhood.
Yes.
So.
Childhood being the key thing. We're talking about adulthood.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking about ideas that really change the world, that really have a revolutionary impact, such as, you know, the iPhone or something like that. So, I mean, you know, you commend Dick Drew as this innovator, and I'm fairly certain that a lot of terrible ideas have also come from 3M. And with the bartender Don Lee, you even point out that most of his experiments were utter failures. His attempt to carbonate a cherry didn't exactly
work. Yeah, and even, you know, and even his bacon old-fashioned is very divisive. Like, I'm not sure how I feel about it.
Yeah. Have you tried it?
I have. Like, the first sip is delicious, and then it's kind of unsettling. I think it says more about my limitations as a consumer, as an eater.
Yeah.
So, and a lot of people don't like it. So, that's a...
Well, who ultimately determines whether it's creative or not? I mean, I could go ahead and just spend an evening being completely stoned out of my mind and come up with stupid ideas, and that could also be conceptual blending.
Yeah.
I mean, what is the distinguishing quality here?
Well, that's why I think when defining creativity, one has to invoke the second life of the idea. One has to invoke this notion that it has to be useful to yourself and other people.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of my favorite stories of moments of insight, I talk about moments of insight and imagine and kind of the neuroscience of it, you know, and why they happen when we least expect them. But there's this great story of an insight by Oliver Wendell Holmes when he first took laughing gas for the first time. And he's stoned out of his mind, high as a kite.
Yeah.
While high as a kite, has this big epiphany. He solved the world. You know, this grand solution. Writes it down on a cocktail napkin, then can't find the cocktail napkin and wakes up the next day. He's hungover, searches everywhere, finally finds a cocktail napkin, so excited to read it, and what it says is, the world smells like turpentine.
Yeah. But there were failed economic theories that were also written on cocktail napkins,
yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, so that's why I think, you know, one has to separate the phenomenology of the idea, to use a $10 word, like the feeling of the insight, like, oh my God, I've made this great connection.
Yeah.
And I think we've all had the experience, or many of us had the experience of being stoned or high and being like, that was such a brilliant epiphany. And then you wake up in the morning and you realize it's useless. So
yes.
I think when talking about creativity, one should talk about the second life, and hopefully not just in the most brute financial terms. You know, I don't think we should get in the business of just measuring creativity by how many books you sell or whether or not it can be monetized, et cetera, et cetera. But we should talk about the second life, because that, I think, is the ultimate way our new ideas are measured.
Yeah. Well, to go ahead and get into some of what you've written in the book, late, you write that Alex Osborne's idea of brainstorming was, in fact, wrong. That's been pointed out by numerous people. Why then does your book skim over the really terrible ideas? I mean, how do we reconcile Osborne with the Carson Peters Higgins study involving 86 Harvard undergraduates, in which those who considered the irrelevant details were 7 times more likely to be rated as eminent creative achievers? Now, being ranked as an eminent creative achiever is a lot different from, say, inventing the iPhone or coming up with something that is actually
of
helpful.
Course. So, So their ranking of creativity, and what I liked about this study is that it was real-world creativity. A lot of limitations of the way scientists study creativity are creativity tests. You know, so it's tests of divergent thinking, coming up with uses for a brick, finding ways to solve traffic in the Bay Area, stuff like that. But it's not about the real world, so what I liked about that study was it was real-world creative achievement. So to get back to your question about why I don't spend a lot of time on the failed ideas...
Because that would seem to be important, you know?
Yeah, no, well, you know... One of the subplots of the book, at least as that I tried to engineer into the book, is this notion that there's no success without failure. One of the defining features of successful creators is the way they've learned how to fail successfully. So, you know, one of my favorite lines in the book is Leon Krinch's quote, the director of Toy Story 3, about the secret sauce of Pixar is failing as fast as possible. You know, you go through iteration after iteration. That's why I've got that whole chapter on the importance of revisions and drafting and the unconcealing process and... Going through drafts, looking for your failures, and trying to fix them. So, you know, hopefully I made it clear that all good ideas emerge from the litter of lots of bad ones, and that even the best epiphanies, you still have to edit them, you still have to fine-tune them and perfect them. So hopefully it's implicit in the book that part of coming up with good ideas is this entangled relationship with bad ideas. As for why I don't talk a lot about failed ideas in the book, why I don't harp on those inventions that never worked, I don't know. I mean, to be honest, I'm sure it's just as a storyteller, it's easier to tell stories of success. It's easy, you know, and that's what interests me more. No one wants to buy a book that's all about.
You're more of a Mike Daisy type than a New York Times guy.
How'd I go from wanting to tell success stories to being a Mike Daisy type?
Well, because we're talking about facts versus storytelling, which is an ongoing debate, especially in 2012, with John DeGatta and Jim Fingal's Lifespan of a Fact, with Mike Daisy.
Well, so what's the dichotomy? I mean, what are facts versus storytelling?
The point I'm trying to make here is, if you are telling a story where everything could be a conceivable success, I mean, there are some things that are inevitably failures. John Carter is probably, by every standard, a failure. I mean, it's lost more money than any movie.
Yeah, but how does that, to get back to your question about facts and stories, how does that, I'm trying to talk about creativity and where it comes from. I think one of the defining features of creativity, you know, like I said before, it's a new idea that people find useful. So there are obviously lots of ideas which people don't find useful, lots of failed ideas. In my book, I try to make clear that failure is a part of the creative process. One should learn how to deal with it.
Yeah.
But I don't see, one doesn't have to write a book about creativity and talk about all the bad ideas that don't work out. That'd be a very, 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 very long book, and I think fairly incoherent. So that's why most of the stories I tell in the book are stories where because that's part of what creativity is, that's how I define it, it's a new idea that works. So I tell the story of new ideas that works.
Okay.
But I don't quite understand how that means I'm Mike Daisy, but...
Well, I mean, because Mike Daisy took facts to fit his larger narrative. And while, you know, from a liberal standpoint, I suppose you could argue that looking at Shenzhen, even if the facts aren't entirely airtight, might in fact be a good idea. There's still this
element. Well, so which facts am I aligning to make my larger narrative? I guess that's my point.
Well, when you say that you can learn from every failure, and there'll be a success from there. I mean, that's, I don't know if that's entirely the truth. There,
I'm not saying you can learn from every... I don't say that anywhere in the book that all ideas are created equal. In fact, the whole point of why brainstorming doesn't work, you brought up Alex Osborne's failed idea, is because that treats all ideas as equal. That means, you know, the whole point of brainstorming is all ideas are useful, all ideas are good. And as I point out, the reason brainstorming doesn't work is because groups that engage in criticism and debate and dissent, groups that point out that idea is actually a piece of shit, they do much better. They come up with more ideas and those ideas are better. So hopefully a theme of the book, as I've been trying to make clear, is this notion of being honest about which ideas are good and which ideas are bad, identifying failures and fixing them. And out of that process, which is often, you know, dismal and unpleasant and insufferable, out of that long process, you will hopefully get a good idea.
Okay.
But there is no shortcut around it.
You talked with Milton Glaser, the graphic designer who came up with the I Love New York logo. You mentioned W.H. Auden, how he was hopped up on Benzedrine to produce his poems. You say that it was persistence, this determination to solve the problem of how to rehabilitate the image of New York City, which led to Glaser's solution. But aside from Earl Miller's recursive loop and his dopamine findings, I'm curious what science you have to back up this idea of the value of persistence to the creative mind. I mean, is it not possible that maybe Glaser's idea caught on because, well, New York was kind of stuck with it because that I Love New York was everywhere, you know what I mean?
Or,
and also, there's also this troubling idea of, like, well, do we have to be hopped up on Benzedrine to be a poet?
No, definitely not. You know, as Auden himself would discover, there's a reason why Benzedrine is now illegal.
Yes.
We no longer prescribe it for asthma. It's incredibly addictive, and as they point out in the book, comes with all sorts of terrible side effects, like horrible constipation and, you know, insomnia and heart arrhythmias, and definitely don't want to advocate Benzedrine, no matter how much you need to edit your poetry. In terms of the science on persistence, yeah, there's a lot of interesting research, a lot of which has nothing to do with the brain, at least not yet, which I think demonstrates that persistence, the technical term for persistence that psychologists study is grit. This is primarily the work of Angela Duckworth. She's at Penn. I'm actually writing about her now, writing an article about her. She's shown in many domains that grit is the single biggest predictor of success, so more than IQ scores. So if you're trying to figure out which 12-year-old will win the national spelling bee, it's about grit. Who's going to last at West Point, it's about grit. Who's going to last at Teach for America, which amateur golfers are going to make the PGA Tour. She argues that grit also plays a very, very important role in the creative process. She always quotes the Woody Allen line that 80% of success is showing up.
Yeah.
Well, grit is what allows you to show up again and again. The two components of grit, and you know, it's important to point out, it's not just about persistence, and I think this is an important caveat. It's not just about persistence. You also have to have the right, you know, the right goal in the first place. So, like, I may want to play in the NBA, but, I mean, you're looking at me. It's not going to happen. So I have to have someone tell me early on, hopefully, all the grit in the world, all the persistence in the world won't turn me into Spud Webb. Find a different goal. So I think sometimes one of the problems we have is we're not willing to help people kind of, you know, dreams will come true if you simply try for it, you know, that kind of talk. Sounds really good, but it's not entirely honest. And I think we have to be honest about it not being honest.
That's a completely reasonable assessment. Why then would you put W.H. Auden on Benzedrine then in the book? Is this sort of the worst case scenario, even though he actually ended up coming up with a number of great poems?
Well, you know,
if we're talking about reasonable applications of what we're talking about here for people to find their creative roots, why would you go for these more extraordinary examples like,
why I chose that song in particular?
Yeah, I'm just curious. Like, why'd you include a Benzedrine addict? Genius, yes, he may have very well have been, you know?
Sure. To be honest, the reason I chose Auden is because I've long been an Auden fan, and I've always been fascinated why when you look at his most anthologized poems. And my favorite Auden poetry is actually his late poetry. So actually after he weaned himself off Benzedrine, that was a brutal process. But I actually love, like, In Praise of Limestone, his later poetry, which is a little messier, a little more chaotic, a little more personal. But when you look at his most anthologized poems, they really come from this three-year window when he was really on Benzedrine, September 1st, In Memory of Yeats, et cetera, et cetera. And I was interested in, like, why that is. What allowed him to, in this narrow window, produce poems that were spare and precise and transparent and really, really popular.
Sure.
And have resonated with people for decades. And so that's why I chose Auden, both because I liked him and because I was, you know, I had this lingering interest in this particular phase of his career. That's why I chose him. It wasn't for, you know, I wasn't trying to pick an extreme example. For me, it was the storytelling challenge in that chapter was, in the end, the point I'm trying to give readers is incredibly banal. And I'm sure I think most readers will realize, in the end, the point of that chapter is sometimes you have to work really hard.
Yeah.
Not the most exciting idea. And so for me, the reason I chose Auden is because, you know, it's drugs, it's Benzedrine. And that struck me as a slightly more interesting way to, in the end, make this point that creativity is also about hard work, you know? And Milton Glaser's motto says it best, art is work.
But wait a minute, so if the underlying point of the chapter is banal, then why stretch out a chapter? I'm not saying that...
Well, because that's an important part of the creative process. I wish I could write a book in which the whole point was take showers when you're stuck, get relaxed, which is part of the process too. I think there's good evidence for that. But, you know, when you talk to creative people... I'm trying to tell the story of creativity as I see it from talking to people in the business and from the perspective of scientists who study it. A big part of creative success is showing up, is putting in the work, going after the drafts. That's not the sexy stuff, but that needs to be in there too.
But isn't it your job to sex it up, Jonah? I mean, you know, you're a guy we're cracking up over about aerosol cheese spray, right?
I do my best to sex it up, which is why I begin the chapter by talking about Benzedrine.
Yeah.
That was my attempt to sex up a very banal chapter. Hopefully the chapter itself isn't banal. The idea in it is, you know, if you've ever done anything worthwhile in your life, you know it takes work, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like... So my challenge as a storyteller in that chapter was, gosh, so I got to put this in here because that's a huge part of the creative process. There's no getting around it. But how can I make it interesting? I can't just talk about hard work. That's a chapter I wouldn't want to write and people wouldn't want to read. So the way I begin it is by talking about this poet who's incredibly talented poet. You know, like, I'm not saying if we all take Benzedrine, we'll pump out September 1st, 1939.
Yeah.
Having dabbled in amphetamines myself, all I got out of it was several nights of insomnia. But I think it does, within the context of Auden, help show how this drug modulated his poetry a little bit, helped him produce a different kind of poetry, which ended up becoming more popular. And I should point out, he hated the popularity of these poems.
Yeah.
He left September 1st, 1939, his most popular poem out of his collected poetry. So
sure.
So he wrestled with it and hated it. And then, you know, Goldwater... LBJ used an excerpt of that poem, a line, in his political ads in 1964, and so that repulsed Auden. So he really struggled with this poetry his entire life, but it is, here's the ironic twist, his most popular poetry. And so that's what interests me about him.
Sure. You bring up Brian Uzzi and Jarrett Spiro's work involving how a Q rating, a metric that is devised on social intimacy, was assigned to various Broadway musicals. The higher the Q rating, the more likely that that musical would succeed. Now, I actually went to the collaboration and creativity paper, and this was interesting. I mean, what you didn't point out was that the Q rating was actually based on Stanley Milgram's small world theory.
Yeah.
And also, the small world quotient here is actually like this cluster coefficient ratio, basically measuring the average fraction of an actor's collaborators who are also collaborators with one another, divided by a path length ratio, which measures the average number of intermediaries that are between all actors in the network. So it's not so much the social intimacy, it's kind of about who you know. And I'm wondering why you didn't unpack that a little bit more, even name check Milgram in that, because clearly
sure.
You're suggesting that the solution is social intimacy, but it's more than just being social. It's also being kind of a go-getter and also knowing certain people.
Well,
and, you know, it's more complicated, I think.
Yeah, no. I mean, you have to say it's a very complicated study. And I think, you know, the larger distinction you're making, this is something Brian Uzzi and I have talked about extensively, is the tension between his study looks at two things. It looks at global factors and local factors. So the global factor is he measures this in a study on a year-by-year basis. So he finds that some years, for whatever reason, there's a lot more mixing in the Broadway community, and that those years that people that plays tend to are more likely to be successful than in years like decades like the 1920s, in which you had lots of repeat relationships and there's a lot less mixing. So even though you had lots of talent on Broadway, there weren't a lot of hit plays. And this is something Uzzi struggled with a lot. So his main paper, the one from 1945 to 1998, looks at just global factors. He's looked at a local paper, which looks more at the team dynamics of individual musicals, so it's a much smaller data set. And in the book, I talk about both. And perhaps I should have name-checked Stanley Milgram. I don't think Stanley Milgram's doing just fine without being name-checked in my book. You know,
is it because other people like Gladwell have brought up Milgram that you wanted to avoid naming him again? Or?
Honestly, it was just because, you know, it honestly never occurred to me. I mean, Brian Uzzi is a name who people don't know, so...
Yeah.
That's kind of why I talked about Brian Uzzi's work, and I'm not sure how much Stanley Milgram's notion of the small world is really what, you know, Brian Uzzi didn't talk about Stanley Milgram, so I try to take my cues from scientists. If Brian Uzzi was always talking about Stanley Milgram and how influenced he was, I'd be sure to name check Stanley Milgram, but Brian Uzzi never brought him up. In terms of the global...
He's pretty dominant, though, in the paper, though, you know?
What
I mean, they mentioned Milgram, small world, where they're talking about the Q rating.
Okay, you know, that's a fair point. Yeah, I mean, maybe I should have mentioned Stanley Milgram. I mean, again, I don't think Stanley Milgram needs my help. And Brian Uzzi never mentioned him, so I'm just telling you why I didn't put him in.
Sure.
You know, for Brian Uzzi, I think it's interesting. He's struggled with trying to measure the local component of this, the actual team that studies musicals. So he's got some data suggesting that it actually plays the local role. The team itself plays a big role, too, in determining the creative success of a musical. At the very least, he argues that all these global mechanisms still have to work through some local means, that you still need collaborators working on one musical. It's not some mystical process in which this global network just produces better plays. So that's why when you talk to Uzzi, the conversation naturally goes back and forth between global local. He'll talk about decades like the 1920s in which, you know, there are lots of repeat relationships, and I talk about this in the book, and yet people didn't produce hit plays. But it'll also bring up single case studies like West Side Story, which is just one team, and that's not a global phenomenon at all, and he argues that Q also played a role there. So he's a researcher who studies both, and that's what I tried to get across in the book.
Sure. You bring up Charlene Nemeth's idea of dissent's relationship to creativity. You write, the power of dissent is really about the power of surprise. But I'm wondering if that's entirely the case. I mean, I went again to Nemeth's own paper on the subject, and she stated, complacency is the real danger. So isn't it less about tearing someone apart and more about sustaining a creative environment that accounts for all opinion and all dissent? And you know, that's really what she would seem to be talking about to me, and I'm wondering why you sort of sandwich it into this idea of the power of surprise.
Well, and that again comes from my conversations with Nemeth. I've talked to her extensively, and you know, one of the great stories she tells is she first got the idea for doing her latest work on debate and dissent, which is also, you know, she's done studies that just looked at surprise. So after I have that quote, I believe I talk about how even when the feedback is wrong, you know, when you have a Confederate in the group who shouts out the wrong answer, which is, must be incredibly annoying, that you still see a benefit from that. That even useless dissent is, you know, is helpful.
And even she argues incorrect dissent, yes.
Incorrect dissent is helpful. And she argues that's because it is surprising. People register that as, oh my God, it kind of wakes them up. It's invigorating. So she argues that's one of the payoffs of debate and dissent. So that's why I argue that I think surprise is important. I'm just talking about her arguments. She tells this great story to get back to what I was talking about originally about how she was on a video conference call and she realized that like nobody was paying attention. It was like supposed to come up with new ideas about how to implement some curriculum, but nobody was paying attention because they were all like emailing on mute. And she realized like that was must be what a lot of brainstorming meetings are like. Where when every idea is equal,
yeah.
When there are no bad ideas, we kind of just throw out our own idea and then we turn off. When we're worried about being criticized and kind of interested in dishing out constructive criticism ourselves, you know, we're just more awake, we're more present. And every once in a while, you know, perhaps when our ideas get criticized, that surprises us. And so we look at the question from their perspective for a second, and that's a good thing. You know, if I had to pick out a real caveat with her research, I think it's the challenge. And this is where I think the science is just limited. The real caveat is it's one thing to advocate debate and dissent and criticism. And I honestly believe I think her work and the work of others on why brainstorming doesn't work is very persuasive. But the real challenge is coming up with a way to have a culture in which it doesn't get out of control.
Yeah.
You know, in which the debate and dissent aren't just reckless and the criticism isn't nasty and personal. And I don't think there's any clear answer to that yet. I mean, I think it's something even Pixar, who's kind of my business case study in that chapter, they're still working on that. You know.
But even in Pixar's early days, when you have Steve Jobs running amok and just tearing people to shreds,
brutal honesty.
But this is like exactly the kind of disruptive thing that takes something that might be a harmless form of dissent, this maybe more in the surprise, complacency model. I mean, you know, do you see any distinction between like Steve Jobs over the top and the sort of usual complacency, egalitarianness of ideas and that kind of thing?
Yeah, no. Hopefully, you know, what Namath is trying to sketch out is what that middle ground might look like.
Yep.
And I think it's easy to speculate on in the lab. I think it's much harder to execute. So I, you know, I honestly don't know if any company's got it right. I mean, I think Pixar is pretty close, but even they have got high turnover and a lot of people aren't cut out for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, having sat in on those meetings, like they can get rude and intemperate and people get their feelings hurt. And sometimes that's necessary, but, you know, a lot of people can't take that, and we got to find a way to have them in the creative process too sometimes. So,
did Namath tell you that it was necessary to be really absolutely hardcore and rude? Or
No, not at all. I mean, she actually, unbeknownst to me, I didn't told her at Pixar or anything, but she brought up their plussing approach, which is, you know, you don't just tear someone down. You add a plus to it. You say, that idea won't work,
sure,
but here's how to make it better. It's a great aspiration. They don't always do it either.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe that's just, you know, I think Steve Jobs' real recognition was that creativity requires trade-offs, that sometimes it means you're going to get your feelings hurt, sometimes it means you're going to have to work late, et cetera, et cetera. Like I read the Isaacson book, and maybe it was just me, but I read that book, and I was like, the guy's a monster.
Yeah,
like,
I did.
He's a horrible man. Yeah. Like, I went in, you know, I love my iPad as much as the next guy. I went in, like, I really like the guy, and then you come out of the book being like, such an asshole and often so unnecessary.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's definitely a middle ground between Steve Jobs' brutal honesty and kind of the egalitarian, all ideas are good ideas. I just don't think we've got a model yet for how to execute that. And I'm not sure science can really show us. I mean,
all ideas are good ideas even though Osborne is wrong.
Yeah. Maybe that's the first step. But I mean, to me, this also does reveal, you know, the limitations of the science because what this, you know, what Namath's experiments consist of is you bring 20-year-olds into a lab and you have them, you divide them into different conditions, brainstorming and dissent conditions and so on. And then you have them generate ideas, but they don't have to come, they don't have to show up for work the next day. They don't have to spend the next 10 years of their life together. They don't have to go to office parties together. This is just a one-off shot. So, you know, the criticisms that resonate with me of the criticisms of brainstorming are the ones that, you know, brainstorming may not be an idea generation task, and it clearly fails by that standard in the lab, but maybe it's a morale booster. Maybe it's just a way to kind of foment mixing in the office. Maybe, you know, and then I'm all for it, I guess. But if it's an idea generation task, which is what it always pretends to be, it doesn't work. But that's my larger point about I don't think we know how to execute debate and dissent yet.
Sure. In writing about Pixar, also, you bring up Ray Oldenburg and Third Places, this interactive environment that is neither home nor office. You write, what makes the Pixar studios so unique is that these spaces have become part of the office itself. Now, wait a minute there, Jonah. I don't know if that makes it a third place, because when I think of a third place, I think barbershop, I think bowling alley.
You think a coffee shop like this?
Even at the bookstore, maybe, or in a place like this. Hey, we're in a third place, maybe. So, you know, if it's at the office, it's at the office. Funny. So what of this here?
Well, it's very funny you mentioned that, because I sent a draft to someone at Pixar just to kind of get their take on it. And one of his big comments was, you know, you're wrong about that. Like, we're still in the office because they serve me pizza on, I think his exact line was, just because they serve me pizza on Saturday doesn't mean I'm not working on a Saturday.
So if you're aware of this, then why did you write that? Come on, man.
Yeah, no. Well, you know, I laughed with him and we talked about it. But I think what I was trying to get across there is not these are literal third spaces, because they're actually not. They're obviously within an office. But what Pixar tries to do, and this is, I think, part of the way they just compensate people for working long hours, is they build in pockets of the office, and vast stretches of the office are just about this. They have 11 drinking holes on campus. They have this beautiful Luxo Cafe. They serve free Pete's coffee all day long in this gorgeous little coffee shop, is that they try to fill the office with spaces that don't feel like the office. That's all I was trying to get across. But I think you're right to point out it was badly put.
The implication, though, is that the reader comes away from this not really understanding what a third place is. I mean, you could have even investigated further and, like, well, see, as you can see, Pixar is taking the idea of the third place and trying to also create a sort of hybrid between workplace and third place.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say.
That would have been a sentence, man.
Well, that's what I meant to say. So I think you're right, it was badly put. You know, I obviously explained what they are before that. And all I was trying to point out is I think Pixar does a good job. And now this is kind of a office design cliche, you know.
Yeah.
They all have ping pong tables and, like, faux or sats, third places. You know, I was trying to show that they go above and beyond in filling their office with spaces that don't feel like the office. And that's all I was trying to get across. But clearly, you're still working long hours and you're still in the office.
Sure. In your chapter on urban friction, you get into how two physicists, Jeffrey West and Louis Bettencourt, the guys behind the Santa Fe Institute, where you should go if you want to meet Cormac McCarthy, they built an equation based on urban variables. This was an effort to uncover a mathematical basis for why any city feels unique. You tisk West and Bettencourt a bit for bringing up an old study from Mark and Helen Bornstein, which measured the average walking speeds of pedestrians in cities around the world. Now, this gives us interpersonal collisions tied to a specific place. And I'm totally with you there. Now, here's where I have to ask you.
Yeah.
I mean, then you try to suggest the Homebrew Computer Club, which is a subcultural community, not a city, that this is indicative of the West Bettencourt model. You then bring up Martin Roof's investigations about how social contracts are important for entrepreneurship. So, again, I'm not sure how these entirely separate aspects or experiments has to do with the original ideas from West about interpersonal collisions. So can you explain how these three separate ideas, what they have to do to each other? I mean, did Jeffrey West apply any of his ideas to this? Because it seems to me in the book that he's talking about how the impersonal nature of corporations makes a case, actually, for the possibilities of city in this and this magnificent city equation that he and Bettencourt were cooking up.
Yeah, so let me try to reconstruct my thought process in that chapter. So Jeffrey West data mined cities, and he's got this interesting thing. I mean, you know, as you point out, one of the predictive correlations of patterns per capita in cities, the walking speed of pedestrians, which is bizarre and could be an accident. West is pretty convinced it's not.
You're not much
of
a walker, I take it.
Oh, I'm a big walker. You know, just when you look at the... Yeah, anyways, I'm not sure. You know, these are correlations, and as I point out, it's, you know, it could just be a correlation. But so West also has this data showing that the San Jose metropolitan area, Silicon Valley, has produced an unusually large number of patents per capita going back four decades. And he says his line is something, and I'm paraphrasing, or something like, there's a reason Silicon Valley is in that valley. It's not a historical accident. It is because this valley does something special. He then goes on to say, like, I don't know what that is. I'm not an urban theorist. Well, he's the definition of an urban theorist, but he's not an urban historian. He hasn't looked into history. But that prompted me to then look into the history of it. Like, why is Silicon Valley in that valley? So the only direct connection between the research, I think, in this chapter on cities is just that West has identified Silicon Valley as something worth investigating. And so then I wanted to figure out, well, why is Silicon Valley in that valley? What is it about? What's the secret sauce of this fairly suburban development. Go to Silicon Valley, and if you love New York City, you probably won't love Silicon Valley. Not a lot of sidewalk action, not a lot of, you know, Jane Jacobs-y things going on.
Yeah.
And yet they found a way to, I think, replicate a lot of the Jane Jacobs ballet, you know, the same stuff she talked, she romanticized in The Village. So that's where I went to Annalise Saxenian and looked at her case study of Route 128 in Boston versus Silicon Valley and why Silicon Valley became the high-tech center of the world. And she talks about horizontal interactions and the Homebrew Computing Club. So, I mean, you're absolutely right that that is one of, you know, the Homebrew Computing Club was a subculture within a larger civic area. I'm not sure I'd, you know, Silicon Valley at the time wasn't like a mad city or anything.
It wasn't like that every resident of San Jose at the time was in fact a member of the Homebrew Computer Club.
No.
That's why I'm sort of like, you
sure,
know, sort of
sure,
suspicious
but, you know,
here.
I think cities do enable those kinds of cultures, though. They enable subcultures, right? Because they're just big spaces, and we're living in a density where we can find the other person who's also obsessed with building a, you know, computing kit in 1979.
But how do you align this back up with West? Is this just a riffing off of an idea? Are you trying to make a legitimate connection here? Or?
Well, the connection is as I lay it out in the chapter. I mean, I think West has raised the question of, look, we know cities are these amazing things. We know cities unleash our innovation. We know as cities get bigger, everyone in that city becomes productive, that they are super linear, and cities are the most important invention in human civilization, he argues. And, you know, so I wanted to talk about, when you talk about innovation and creativity, you have to talk about cities because that's where all our good ideas come from. But he's also got this interesting point, which is, you know, Silicon Valley is an outlier, and it's been an outlier for a long time. And so, like I said, that's what led me to figure out, well, what does Silicon Valley do well? And so that is the extent to which they're connected. I hope I don't imply otherwise in the book. I mean, I think, you know, I set up Saxenian's work and my potted history of the Homebrew Computing Club. And, you know, Tom Wolfe actually has this amazing profile of basically Silicon Valley. I believe it was an Esquire in the early 80s where he talks about just all these guys, engineers working at these firms that don't exist anymore. And they've all been there for like 6 weeks. They're all meeting for beers, talking about problems. And it's just like this great portrait.
A portrait, though. I mean, Tom Wolfe wasn't exactly hard with the facts.
Yeah. And that's why all I do is like quote, you know, one paragraph from that thing where he talks about all these guys sharing beers. You know, the other data which suggests that a big part of Silicon Valley's secret is just high turnover are studies of the turnover rate. That it was like 2.5 years in the 1980s. That one of the big reasons I think Silicon Valley is in California, at least, is that California can't enforce non-compete clauses.
Yeah.
That through a quirk of the legal code, you can, you know, like Mark Hurd, fired from HP, starts working at another huge firm the next week.
Yes.
You couldn't do that in any other state. And that allows people to, especially in the tech sector, to leave a firm, go to a competitor, and start working right away before their knowledge becomes obsolete. So, honestly, that's, I think, been a big factor. So, you know, that's the extent to which I hope those two things are set up. I mean, I think what West is studying is obviously from such a macro perspective, you're always going to have to finesse a little bit how one goes from the macro data mining perspective down to the individual case study.
Sure.
But that, I mean, that's one of the things I wanted to do in the book is really collapse these levels of analysis. So I wanted to talk about the data miner, and I wanted to talk about the urban historian. I want to talk about, you know, the neuroscience, and I also wanted to zoom out and talk about Shakespeare and Elizabethan England.
You bring up the Dunker candle problem where you have people who are given a cardboard box, corkboard, matches, thumbtacks, and a candle, and they are asked to attach the candle to the corkboard so that it can burn without dripping onto the floor. Instead of using this, though, as an opportunity to delve into functional fixedness, which is basically what this demonstrates, whereby people often have this difficulty finding new functions for old things, you instead say that this relates more to a 2009 INSED study where students who lived abroad were significantly more likely to solve a difficult creativity problem than those who never lived outside their country. But let's go back to the functional fixedness. Robert Adamson comes along after Dunker and he splits the participants into two groups. You have those who are given all the items in the cardboard box, and you have those who are given the cardboard box as is, and he sees an uptick in results for understandable reasons,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So given Adamson's, why should you have to leave the country in order to solve a problem. What other contemporary studies, aside from this NSAID thing, demonstrates this connection between functional fixedness and creativity?
You mean what other studies besides...
Besides the NSAID one you cited,
Well, Adam Galinsky, who's the researcher, who's he's actually at the Kellogg School Northwestern, who did the original study on living abroad, he's done several follow-ups. In fact, I'm actually writing a column about one of his follow-ups, which looked at a case study of, because you know, the knock against that study is the Dunker Candle problem itself is too artificial a task, and that kids, some kids learn it in Psych 101. So, you know, if you've already heard of it, then, you know, maybe you don't tell the researchers. So some people argue that it's just some of the data is messy. And living abroad, obviously, there are confounding variables there. So there are reasons to be, I think, suspicious of just that one study. But he's since done several follow-ups. The one I'm writing about has to do with fashion designers.
Yeah.
And he looks at dual identities. So people who, if you're raised in France and now you live in the States or vice versa, or if you describe yourself in dual terms. So you're an Asian-American fashion designer, for instance. You know, you have
more
identities.
Is that related also to functional fixedness?
Yeah, so they also are rated as more innovative by their peers and also perform higher on tests of divergent thinking and functional fixedness.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the question is then why didn't you include that in the book? That would have been a...
Well, because that study came out 2 months ago.
2 months ago? Okay.
So, yeah, so it's a brand new study. I mean, obviously, I wish I would have, because that to me is much more interesting than looking at undergrads who lived abroad.
But when you have something like the Dunkel Candle problem, I mean, you know, what do you do to select present examples that fit the bill of this? I mean, you know, aside from that NSAID study, I mean, it seems to me this could open up a huge discussion about your book, and yet you only have the NSAID study in that chapter and around that time.
The huge discussion just about functional fixedness.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It seems to be a very vital part of creativity.
It absolutely is. And I think a lot of the creative stories I describe are examples of functional fixedness. Just I don't always use the exact nomenclature.
Why not? That's what everybody else does, you know?
Well, you know, I do when I feel like it's helpful. But sometimes you just want to tell a story without having to say, this is an example of functional fixedness. The Post-it note story I tell is an example of functional fixedness, too. Like, everyone had said, here's this weak glue that it's on the shelf for 3 years. And no one knew what to do with a weak glue because it violates, you know, the glue should have a function of being strong until they come up with a Post-it note, and that's during a daydream in the church and everything. But that's functional fixedness. Pure and simple. I just don't call it functional fixedness because I don't know. It just seemed like a term I didn't need right then and there.
But if that's the term in common usage, you have a possibility to invite your readers to get excited about functional fixedness. So if you avoid the term, then you don't actually empower the readers go look up shit like me. You know?
So yeah, no, you know, it, something I struggle with as a science writer is when exactly you use the nomenclature of science. You know, and you name drop all the acronyms.
Yeah.
And, you know, one thing my editor thinks I do too much of is name drop acronyms like functional fixedness. And I think there is a sense in which at least I as a reader enjoy it. I mean, like, I think, like, you know, when you read The New Yorker, it's always fun to, like, learn a new term that you then say, oh, that academic introduced that. And you come away feeling smarter. So that's why I enjoy that. So sometimes I leave them in, but sometimes you just want to tell a story and get out of the way. So it's a balancing act.
So you feel a duty to avoid these terms to attract a larger readership? Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't avoid the terms, which is why I use functional fixedness. And, you know, I talk about brain areas in particular, like the anterior superior temporal gyrus. I don't just say the right hemisphere because, you know, I think specificity is important. But you know, when I'm telling a story about Post-it notes, I don't feel the need to name drop functional fixedness. So that's why, you know, but it's something I struggle with as a writer is when exactly to delve into the precise terminology of science. When I'm describing science, I'm much more likely to use a terminology. When I'm talking about Post-it notes, I don't feel the same need to say this is an example of functional fixedness.
Okay. One last and fairly large question before I cut you loose from here.
Yeah.
So two scientists, Tim Requarth and Meehan Crist, responded to your book over at The Millions, pointing out that your mashup method of citing numerous anecdotal examples as a catch-all for creativity was problematic. They pointed out that you criticized the limitations of functional MRI in a Wall Street Journal column while simultaneously relying upon similar data in a very non-specific matter to support an apparent thesis that the acts of letting go has inspired some of the most famous works of modern culture. Now, to your credit, you did show up with the comments, you manned up there, and you wrote that Eric Kandel's The Age of Insight has many chapters on functional MRI data combined with musings on aesthetics and beauty.
Well, it's not just science writers and popular books which talk about fMRI. fMRI is the dominant technique of modern cognitive neuroscience.
Yes, well, I'm not finished yet. And you asked, is this inappropriate? As it so happens, I happen to have read Mr. Kandel's book. In fact, I have it right here, and I can even, you know, I've even bookmarked the actual quote. In chapter 30, Kandel does, as you point out, cite functional MRIs, but he doesn't just cite fMRIs. He is also careful to write this. The two techniques for measuring brain activity complement each other perfectly. EEGs, which are superior for pinpointing when the event occurred, but poor at identifying where it occurred, have good temporal resolution, but poor spatial resolution, whereas functional MRIs have the inverse strengths and weaknesses. At the beginning of your book, you write, by combining both techniques, fMRI and EEG, in the same study, Beeman and Kunios were able to deconstruct the epiphany. Total firm ground there, Jonah. Why then would you not actually apply the same dual standard to this jazz improvisation that these two people in the millions are criticizing you? I mean, you know, Kandel didn't do that. He won the Nobel Prize, you know? So why take a shortcut like that for jazz improvisation?
Yeah. Okay, so a couple things here. It's a really great question, and like I said, you know, as I replied in the comments, I think it's an important discussion to have.
Yeah.
You know, especially covering neuroscience, it's a young field. We know every result we're talking about now is going to be disproven some point in the future. It's a very, very rough draft. We have first draft of the brain. In terms of my criticism of fMRI, I've written about it in the Journal. I've written about it in the New Yorker. I think there are real problems in the literature. My column that they cite in the Journal, and my one problem with their review was that they cut out exactly why I was criticizing this paper in particular. It was because it was not peer-reviewed. It appeared on the New York Times op-ed page first. And the evidence they cited was that the insula lit up. Lit up, you can't see me making quotation marks, but lit up when people are shown their iPhones. The insula lights up in 30% of all fMRI papers. It is an incredibly non-specific response. Nobody knows why this is. I think it's telling us something interesting about the limitations of fMRI. So I was making a specific critique about this paper. I think fMRI in general has real problems, which some of which we know, some of which I'm sure we're bound to discover. In terms of the exact study I cite, there are actually two studies which looked at the science of improv process by different teams, which came up with convergent results. And the main result I was highlighting was the deactivation of a part of the brain called the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex. It's actually a part of the brain which is fairly well mapped out, we think. It doesn't light up in lots of papers. It's not one of these things which just has non-specific responses. It is very closely associated with two things: abstract planning and impulse control.
Yeah.
So like when you plan for the future and you delay gratification, that those are some of the things that light this brain area up. So I was quoting the speculations of scientists, which I think, you know, makes intuitive sense, that when people engage in improv, the reason they're able to do that, they're able to create without worrying about what they're creating, is because they're able to, in a sense, diminish their inhibitions, silence their inhibitions, inhibit their inhibitions. So that's how I cite that paper. You know, as you just pointed out, I talk about the limitations of fMRI in the very first chapter. I say it's we get good spatial resolution, poor timing resolution. In the particular Johns Hopkins study, which I talk about, the DLPFC, they tried to correct for the temporal slowness, the lag. It's a 3 to 5 second lag in fMRI, by having people play for an extended period and by having people improvise within different set melodies. So you're playing something you know and then you improvise. And so they're trying to splice the time. Like I said, it's an imperfection. It's a first draft. And I think they were fair to, you know, it was a fair criticism to make of the book. As someone who's criticized fMRI, I certainly get it. I'm sensitive to it. It's something I wrestle with. That's also why in that chapter, I don't just talk about fMRI studies. I talk about people with frontotemporal dementia. I talk about this, you know, the larger developmental story, why kids are more creative than adults, why they don't worry so much. It's because the DLPFC develops one of the last brain areas to come online. So I try to get at the problem from multiple angles. And that's how I wrestle with the fact of I'm writing about science, which I know is not, you know, it's not dispositive, it's not for sure. So, you know, I try to invoke multiple ways of studying these things.
But when you leave in that last comment, is this inappropriate? You could have just said, you're absolutely right. There's also this situation with the EEG, which, by the way, I pointed out in the book. I mean, it seems to be that you're keeping tabs, but you're sort of hamstrung or restricted by the popular writing medium. And so I'm wondering if this is really a good trade-off for you to make, because I think you've got some interesting stuff to say.
Yeah, but when you know, I don't think I'm hamstrung by the popular science medium. I think this is it's a difficulty of writing about science. You know, I forget the name of the reviewers in the millions, Tim and...
Tim Rickwarth and Meehan Christ.
Yes. So, you know, they clearly are anti-fMRI, but there are lots of scientists who aren't fMRI, you know, who do it all day long for a living. And there are some scientists who do a very, very good job with fMRI and do studies with large sample sizes and very well controlled. And I think that research is worth taking seriously. So to simply say, I think, as they put it, you know, one should not talk about localization in general, or at least, you know, say... Here they came up with this brain error, but that's almost certainly a mistake, or whatever language they'd be satisfied with, I think is to do a disservice to the science. I think there are plenty of bad papers, and I enjoy calling out bad fMRI papers as much as the next one. There's lots of low-hanging fruit, lots of just shit that's easy to just have fun with. But there are also lots of good papers, and so I try to focus on the good papers. And that's why I talk about the Beeman and Cuneo study as well with InSight. Because they went above and beyond by combining EEG with fMRI, and that gave them spatial and temporal resolution. So I try to focus on the good ones. But, you know, I don't think that, as you know, that all fMRI should be neglected or ignored or not written about.
In light of some of what we've discussed, and I appreciate you for doing this, you know, do you think that you're going to be taking greater care in your writing in the future to flesh out some of these details so you don't have these endless comments upon comments, and, you know, you can be very...
No, I enjoyed these conversations. I mean, I wanted to do this, and I replied in those comments because I don't think there is a clear-cut answer to this. I don't think scientists know how to think about fMRI. I'm a science writer. I'm trying to convey where the field is right now. So, you know, I don't obviously want to say everything hinges on this one fMRI experiment. Look, we were all wrong before about creativity, but now we've got this new pretty picture of the brain, and we can say it all begins here. Like, of course, I'm not writing that. I'm trying to take multiple convergent streams of evidence and tell a story about that. So, to be honest, I mean, I read that review, and obviously it was a negative review, and it's not fun to read, but I thought it was interesting. I thought they made good points. I understood their points, but I wouldn't have written it any differently. I stand by the story I tell in that chapter. Eric Kandel read that chapter. He knows what I said, and he understands it. So if Eric Kandel is our gold standard, and, you know, he's someone I consider a mentor. I was lucky enough to work in his lab. He's forgotten more about neuroscience than I will ever, ever hope to know, and he doesn't forget much. I am satisfied with the care I took in trying to, you know, on the one hand, be faithful to where science is, but people are going to disagree about where science is right now. That's a conversation scientists are going to have. That's a conversation, that's a, you know, debate that isn't easily resolved, and people with the best intentions are going to have disagreements about where one should draw the line. So that's what I took that as talking about, and that's why I was interested in being a part of that conversation.
Well, Jonah, thanks for being a part of this conversation.
No,
I really appreciate it. So
thank you for having me. It's a lot of fun.
Thanks. Take care, and it's good talking to you.
Imagine a man, not a child of any revolt, but a plain man tied up in